Before we get started with today's show, you know Ariel Helwani. You see him everywhere on ESPN. He's a really good MMA journalist, and he's got a great MMA podcast called Ariel Helwani's MMA Show. Some episodes, he co-hosts with Daniel Cormier, one of the top five fighters in the sport. That's like me hosting a podcast with Russell Wilson. Just doesn't happen. Other times, he talks to not only the likes of Conor McGregor, but also people like The Rock, Kristaps Porzingis, and Shaq. It's a great listen several times a week, every week. Ariel Helwani's MMA Show. Check it out wherever you get your podcast. Also, we'll be getting to the Glory Time chapter of the Jordan Rules by Sam Smith on Thursday with BJ Armstrong. But remember to tune into The Last Dance, a behind-the-scenes look at the final championship of the Chicago Bulls dynasty. We're going to be discussing episodes 7 and 8 here shortly, but the series continues this Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN with episodes 9 and 10. Don't have access to ESPN? Go to ESPNInstantAccess.com to sign up today or listen to the wrap-up podcast hosted by Jalen and Jacoby immediately following the broadcast. Our coverage of The Last Dance is brought to you by State Farm. When you want the real deal, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Coverage is also brought to you by AT&T. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we got an interview with Christian Dawkins. He was the subject of the HBO documentary, The Scheme, on some of these quote-unquote shenanigans money flying around college basketball. But first, we got to the super competitor episodes of The Last Dance, Gabe. This is the one where Mike starts worrying that y'all ain't gonna like him because he was mean to Scott Burrell. And at one time, he punched Steve Kerr dead in the eye. This is what had Mike shook. Mike was afraid y'all were gonna think y'all didn't like him after seeing these sorts of things. It was also where we got emotional Mike, except not where you thought you would have gotten emotional Mike. We got an episode about Michael Jordan losing his father. An awful situation, terrible circumstance. The way he lost his father, as awful as it was. And what got Michael Jordan to damn near cry? Talk about how bad he wants to win. And the revisiting of all of these things, right? Perhaps he has made peace with his father dying. You know, he's had, you know, almost 30 years now. You know, it's been 27 years since that happened. So I can see the argument that, you know, he's made peace with that. He's gone through whatever healing there was, and now he's at a place where he can talk about that. He is not at the place in his life where he can make peace with losing, where he can make peace with the fact that we out here trying to get this win, and y'all don't want this win as bad as I want this win. He has not resolved that.
The best line out of that whole thing, but that's you. Because you've never won anything.
Yes. You've never won anything. And by the way, I think a lot of people are dismissing that because it is kind of reductive. But at the same time, I get what he's saying. Like the stakes that he's at. How many people play basketball, right? How many people are on basketball teams? How many people want to be in the NBA? How many people have tried at some point in their lives literally to be as good at basketball as they can possibly be? Right. To get to that place where you are better than everybody at this thing that billions of people do. I do understand his belief that it requires a certain drive, right? It requires you push in a certain way. The question is whether or not it requires you to be a right? Because LeBron's approach in this place is different, right? Like LeBron's thing is the other kids aren't as good as me. I need to help make them feel better. You know, and get the best out of them because I understand the other kids aren't as good as me, right? There's a story, I think J.R. Smith told it, but somebody's talking about a story about seeing LeBron's kids. Like they were a bunch of kids are playing around the pool and Bronny did like a backflip into the water. And LeBron came over to him and was like, yo, you got to chill out on doing that. And he's like, why? He's like, because these other kids can't do that. Right? Like they're going to wind up trying to do this and busting their heads on the side of the pool, right? You know, like LeBron's kind of spatial understanding of what it's like to be better than everybody else comes from a much different place than Mike's does. I think part of that is LeBron lived a life, I think, that required him to become an adult sooner than the life that Jordan was required to live. Like LeBron's had to think about things in the context of other people from a very early age. I think in a way that Mike did not, right? One benefit of like the whole two parent stable structure and all that stuff is that as a kid, you ain't got to worry about nobody but yourself. Like my dad always says that the one thing that children should never have to do is worry about the emotional well-being of adults. You know, like you want them to be courteous, you know, you don't want them to be rude and mean or anything like that, but those bigger things aren't things they should ever have to worry about. So you, Michael Jordan, you go from your parents' house to college and playing ball where the game is be as good at basketball as you can, win this, and then you get to the league and the focus is be as good at basketball as you can. Like that's where he is. He locked his life and his mind into this is the thing that he wants to do. And I imagine that it is wildly frustrating. And I said this on Twitter and a few other places. Imagine being that much better than everybody else. But your success depends on everybody else, right? Like where you get depends on how good these other dudes are. Like it depends on how well these other cats play. And what if you just feel like they're not working hard enough? You know, because one thing Mike said in that I thought was interesting was Mike was like, look, man, y'all are standing on my shoulders right now. Like Mike said, he come back from playing baseball. He sees Steve Kerr and Bill Winnington kind of just joking around when they in there like, oh, we on the Bulls. He's like, being on the Bulls means something because of me, right? Being on the Bulls is something you want to do because I was here and we won these three championships. And in the end, if we win three more, it's going to be because I was here, right? Like everybody involved would agree on that. It's going to be because I am here. So you imagine you come in and you see these cats lollygagging, right? I'm out here killing myself every day to try to get this done. And I feel like these dudes don't want it as bad as I do. And the only way that I can get the thing that I want is if these cats want it more. But I can't make them want it more. But I can try to make them want it more. And Mike's approach to try to make you want it more is to make you want to fight somebody. Right? Because that's the lens through which he sees everything is just through hyper competition, right? Me versus you, right? That's where it comes from. And so he winds up being a d- to everybody around him, right? Where I find it interesting in this, I don't want to be like, it's just how you was raised, but I do feel like this speaks to something and how you view the things with Mike. Steve Kerr said it. I fought back and he respected me after the fact because I fought back. Here, Will Perdue and all this stuff. And I'm like, hey, man, did you think about hitting him back? Right? Now, to be fair, I understand why you might not feel like you in the place where you can hit Michael Jordan back because he's Michael Jordan, right? Like, I totally understand. And this is why it's kind of messed up the way that Mike goes about this stuff with people. You got too much clout. Like, the power dynamics here are skewed. You are doing this because you have the upper hand on the power. You want them to buck back at you. But a big part of why they do not buck back at you is because of the power dynamic that you are using to allow you to behave in the way that you do with these people, right? So I look at it through the lens of, A, I have a certain measure of empathy for Mike and how frustrating it must be when these other cats ain't as good as you, right? And you don't feel like they're grinding like you grind. That's the Jimmy Butler thing. Jimmy Butler on every team is just like, why don't you work as hard as I do? That's the thing that you can control, right? I get where he comes from, but that don't mean you got to be talking to him like that, Mike. That don't mean you got to like go about it like that. I also noticed this with Mike. We ain't heard no whole lot of stories about Mike accidentally picking the wrong one to do this with. We ain't hear no stories about Mike doing this with the traveling cocaine circus. You notice that? All these stories about Mike breaking bad with people, they don't really get going. Again, we've been reading the book. They don't really get going till like 88, 89. That's when he started doing that. You imagine if Mike had tried to run up on George Gervin with that?
Mm-mm. There isn't like an anecdote of him trying to make a run at somebody that's older than him that has like more seniority that would have come back.
Well, hold on. Here's what's funny about this. What if he had tried this with Oak? Because on one level, Oak is his boy, right? He back off. Like, that's what would happen. At the same time, he is Oak. You think that happened once, like early? I'm not saying that the person doing the punking is a hero. You know, maybe I see myself through the wrong lens, right? Like, ain't like I ain't never had nobody try to bully me or try to pick on me or something like that, right? And I ain't gonna say that every time it happened, I got out here and I fought somebody. But at the same time, I look at adults getting punked and I'm looking at it like, yo, what you going to do? And you got to have some like means or something to come about it. But I also thought it was funny. After the Steve Kerr story game, Jordan was like, I called the Bertos Center. I was like, please give me Steve Kerr's number. And I was like, of course you wouldn't have Steve Kerr's number. Here's the question. And I guess Steve, maybe it just got to the team, right? That's what people were telling me. But did Mike press *67 before he called?
Back when that was a thing.
Yes.
Back when also like a phone book was a thing.
Yes.
Can you imagine if you were listed in a phone book right now?
Oh, I mean, people still, I mean, I wouldn't be, right? Phone book's still out there.
Yeah, I'm trying to get in touch with a Bomani Jones, New York City. Okay, thanks. I'll wait.
Yeah.
I'll hold while you put me through.
Star 67 is the blackout your caller ID. And that is Mike not wanting Steve Kerr to have his phone number. I just want to talk to you. I don't necessarily want to talk to you again. Like, how many people on the 98 Bulls do you think had Michael Jordan's phone number? I imagine Scotty. Do you think Robin had Jordan's number? I don't. And by the way, if Robin did, I don't think he'd have anything to call Mike about. Do you think that Dickie Simpkins ever got Michael Jordan's phone number?
No.
Rod Harper.
Could also see a Star 67 type situation with him too. Was like, hey, yo, come to the Bulls.
Yes. All right. See, I think the thing with Mike on the phone is like in this day and age, more people would have Mike's number because they'd be on road trips. You know, like you'd have reasons. But back when the home number was really just the number, Mike's like, what Joe Bushler need to call me for?
Back when you had to memorize someone's number.
Yes.
Or have it in a date book.
Yes. I don't know anybody's number anymore. You got to have your number for a long time for me to remember your number at this point. Now, let me throw something else out here, though. I thought about the 7 and 8. I think something that's easy to lose sight of, especially when you start getting into 90s Jordan, is how young he was. And this is something that obviously I didn't properly appreciate like as it was going on because I was much younger. But 3 championships, all that stuff, the Jordan, the brand and all those things. And then his father dies. He's 30 years old, right? Like, I can't imagine what the weight was on Mike's shoulders at that point. Because one thing about this documentary, and I think once it's finished, you know, I'll talk about it with a little more of a critical eye. But one thing that's obvious in watching it is that Michael Jordan has a role in producing this, right? Like, if you don't want it out there, it's not going to be out there, right? Like, you know, this is where we are. As a result, a significant part of this is to let people know how hard it is to be Michael Jordan. You know, like that's a theme that they want to sell in this. And I actually think that that's worthwhile, right? Like I think that that's something that's worth putting out there and giving us insight on. And the exhaustion that he had at the end of the third title run, I found that to be fascinating, right? Because, you know, I was arguing back and forth with this one dude. He probably listening, right? It's Professor Cat. Yeah, he was trying to hit me on some talking about I had a bias against the Bulls because I'm from Houston and because I say I think that the Rockets would win the title in 94, even if Jordan had stayed.
Why you got Vinny on here laughing about Scottie Pippen and you had a dude from L.A.? Why not people from Chicago? I'm like, damn, my bad. The dude from L.A. only covered the Bulls, right? He's like, well, why don't you get one of the sons of Lacy Banks? Lacy Banks used to cover the Bulls for the Chicago Sun-Times. J.A. Adande covered the Bulls for the Chicago Sun-Times, right? But he had concluded that my whole approach, like, well, you got Joe Dumars on here. Wow, because we almost thought it'd be a good idea to have an opponent, right? You're probably going to be mad when you find out B.J. Armstrong is from Detroit, right? But that was his kick on this, is that, like, there's some kind of bias, right? Because I think the Rockets win a championship in 94. Let me ask you this. Looking at how exhausted Mike was at the end of 93, why do you think it's crazy, the idea that the Rockets would have won that in 94. Think about the Raptors winning this championship over the Warriors. That's what that was about. The Warriors ran out of gas after going and doing this over and over and over again. So you imagine carrying the weight of that exhaustion, if you might. Keep it in mind that as the offseason gets shorter because you go through the playoffs and then they did the Dream Team thing, right? And so there's more of that and everything that came with that. And you keep stacking this stuff on top of each other and then your father's killed, right? Like I keep saying his father died, but his father was killed. Right. Like all these things happen. I can't imagine the weight that that would be. And 30 is adult. And yeah, people have all kinds of things happen to them when they're 30 years old.
That's certainly true. But most 30-year-olds do not have as many things on their shoulders as Michael Jordan did. Like, that's part of why, like, the Jesse Helms thing, if there's a place to cut Mike some slack on it, it's the fact that Mike was like 26 or 27 when all of that was going on, right? Like, that's a lot. And we often lose sight of the fact that you reach your prime in athletics far before you reach your prime in your brain, right? Like, your prime as an adult. Adulthood is very, very new to you when you reach your prime in athletics and when you got the chance to make the most money. And so I think it's very easy for us to ignore, and we're a little too hard on these dudes very often, just completely forgetting how young they are and trying to navigate all of these things, you know. And he's navigating this, you know, dude gets married, he's got kids, you wouldn't know it from the movie, but whatever, right? Like, you know, all of those things. I can't imagine what that must have been like for him. And then you out here trying to play some minor league baseball, right? Where there are all these cameras here to watch you struggle. Because he struggled, right? I mean, it was going to be a struggle, right? I think that's something that he understood. But the whole world is here, not necessarily rooting against you. Some people maybe were, but they're still there to watch you struggle after they spent all this time watching you be excellent.
And then you had the media members that were trying to somehow blame the murder on Mike. Woo! And on his gambling. And then to your point about criticizing once he started playing baseball, I had my wanna be like Mike moment when I was watching the documentary and they showed the SI cover. Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, Mike never talked to SI
ever again. Ever again.
I was like, oh man, a list. And you actually get to follow through on it. Yes. Like, somebody did me wrong, never talking to them again. Wouldn't you just love to be able to do that? Like, we don't have that kind of clout.
No. And yo, here's the thing about it. That was so stupid by Sports Illustrated. Who thought that this was a good idea? Like, y'all treating Mike like he disposable. That was the part that got me about it. It's like, oh, you never thought you'd need a relationship with Michael Jordan again? Because to me, it's not even so much about the cover. I thought Mike made a fair point. Y'all didn't even talk to me for this, right? Like, if you decide that you're going to do that and go about it, I thought his point was fair. You didn't ask me why I'm here. You didn't ask me why I care about this. Because, you know, and people, if y'all know me, y'all know I'm 100% fair about this. Every time somebody tells Tim Tebow to stop playing baseball because he's not good at it, I'm like, yo, they keep letting him show up. Right? Like, if this is what you want to do, right? This is what you want to try to make it happen. I applaud these guys who have been excellent at one thing and are willing to be mediocre at something else. Right? Like, I don't know if my pride could let that happen. You know? Like, people like, you going on Celebrity Jeopardy? Y'all ain't gonna see me lose. Right? Like, I don't know who else on there, but the one thing y'all ain't about to do, y'all ain't going to watch me play. Y'all coming to watch me win. Right? Like, I don't know. No, y'all ain't about to watch me lose. Mike's willing to go out there. Y'all can watch him lose. I ain't got it. Like I admit. I am not that person. Mike apparently is that guy, you know? And so you don't come talk to him about it. You don't come ask him anything about it. Did somebody up there just never conclude, you know, maybe Michael Jordan might come back and play basketball again, right? Like, somebody in the meeting needed to be like, you know, he's going to be mad, right? You know what I'm saying?
Was it worth it? You know, because I mean, even what I noticed was in that press conference where Jordan was announcing his retirement for the first time, he did say that he might come back.
Yes.
He said it. So it's like, is this really time to burn that bridge? Like, you really think it's worth it?
Do you really think it's worth it? And apparently somebody did.
This is my shot to get it in on Mike. He's never coming back.
Steve Wolf is the guy who wrote it, who said that he agreed that they were unfair to Mike in that. This comes down to an editor, because, you know, the cover of Sports Illustrated at that time was a very, very big deal. Like, who was the person so thirsty for a hot cover that they were willing to roll the dice on Mike?
And then by virtue, the entire publication. Because if you're saying it's the cover, then you're basically speaking for SI.
Yes. What are you doing?
So everybody on the SI staff is now on the list.
Yep. Everybody.
Nice move.
Way to go, guys. What are you doing?
Meanwhile, at that time, you've got the Pippen thing that happened.
Oh, I forgot.
What did you think about Pippen saying, I'm out?
I mean, Scotty. Dog. And I could get all the anger because apparently he had a great game. And this is what happened to Scotty. Scotty thought he was Mike. Like in the end, Scotty thought he was Mike. Like, okay, I'm the man on this team. That means I take the last shot. And they like, yo, you're not Mike. Tony, you got this, right? And by the way, 1.8 seconds left, Scottie Pippen's not the man you call to play for. He's never been the guy that you called to play for. I don't think since he left Central Arkansas, anybody called to play for him with 1.8 seconds left, right? It didn't happen. Like, this was about something else. And so you're like,
I ain't going in the game.
All right. Ball comes into Kukoc. Kukoc nails the shot, right? Everybody's salty, walking off the court. What if he had missed the shot? What in the world would they have been doing during overtime? Like, you put Scotty back in the game? Does Scotty go back in the game? Like, I feel like if that game goes to overtime, Scotty can't ever come back. Like, you got to trade Scotty that offseason.
That was not the offseason that they were looking to trade Scotty for Sean Kemp. It was the previous year, right? Where that offer was on the table with Sean Kemp.
Oh, I'm not sure, actually.
On draft night. In 1994, Pippen's name was involved in the trade rumors. That would have been back to the Sonics. Yeah.
That would have been after. Yeah. Nah, you'd had to go, buddy. Like, if it had really come to that, they'd have had to go. If the Bulls, for whatever reason, lose that game, nah, Scotty, you'd have to go. That's funny. Scotty said that he would do it again. And I'm like, Scotty just saying stuff, man.
Well, you said he wanted to be like Mike. I mean, that was just kind of like, nah, I would do it again.
But here's my thing. This is why you're not Mike, Scotty. If they didn't call to play for Mike, Mike would have made him call to play for Mike. Mike wouldn't have sat on the bench. Mike, the play would have been for Mike. Like, you just not Mike. Like, I think all the things that ultimately bothered Scotty were Scotty realizing, damn, man, I ain't Mike. You know, Mike goes to play baseball. They pay him his Bulls salary. Mike comes back. They jack up his salary. They don't necessarily have to do that, but they do that. Right? Why? Because he's Mike. Scotty's like, yo, y'all want to redo my contract? Hey, no, deal's a deal. You ain't Mike. You ain't Mike. And look, different people live with that differently. Like, I remember I used to work for Page 2, ESPN.com, when, like, Bill Simmons, a bunch of other people worked there, but particularly Bill. And I remember once, man, I sent an email in about something, and I was just curious because I had asked to write about a topic, and they told me no for whatever reason. And then I looked up, and Simmons had written something about it. And not even mad, I just sent an email. And I was like, hey, guys, I just wanted to make sure I understand what's going on here because I had wanted to write on a very similar topic or something like that. You said no, and then this was up. And I just want to know what the difference was between the two, right? Because it's really in large part just trying to figure out how to pitch to them, right? Figuring out what I did wrong. And the response was, oh, that's easy. It's a different set of rules for Bill. Got it. He's Bill Simmons. I'm not. You know, like, I wasn't like, man, how y'all going to do me like that? It was just like, okay, cool. Glad you said it, right? And that's the thing, Scotty. You're not Mike. You're one of these people that might want to work harder.
They wouldn't have made a Space Jam with Scotty.
No. You are not that guy. Imagine how it felt being Scotty when that shot went in. And imagine how good it felt being Kukoc when that shot went in. Yeah, remember, this is the dude that was over there in the Olympics out here trying to embarrass you in front of the world. He probably still mad at you, always been salty with you. And now you made it. If I was Kukoc, I would have gone to the bench. Like, you know, people go like the scores table and all that. I would have gone and stood right in front of Scotty. What? Yeah. Buckets.
And then they interview Kukoc. Yeah, of course I would have taken that.
Yes. Like, I do this.
Yeah. And like, I'm watching it with my wife, right? And she's become a big Scotty fan as we're watching this just because he's this, like, cool character, right? And she's like, why wouldn't they want to give the ball to Scotty there at the end? That moment and what the strategy would be for Phil in trying to win the game, you need a shot maker.
Yeah.
You know, and Scotty is a great player.
Not what he does.
You know, you got 1.8 seconds. Kukoc is a shot maker.
Yeah, and going to be guarded by someone smaller than him.
Dirk before Dirk.
Right.
Tall guy. I mean, they showed him next to Krause.
Yo, it's so unfortunate for Krause. There's so many pictures of Jerry Krause standing next to people he should never stand next to. Man, such bad breaks. Such bad breaks. I do want to touch that emotional scene after they beat Seattle. I'm stunned that they let a cameraman in there. I can't imagine what that was for him. Like, all those things, like, it's cool for us that we ultimately got to see it, but it is also wild to me that nobody kept that cameraman out. Cause that cameraman's doing his job, right? Like, this is just what it is. I'm supposed to capture this, but I'm surprised there wasn't one person to be like, man, get out of here, man. By the way, what's up with your boy Randy Brown trying to take the ball from Mike when they was down there? Maybe Randy just wanted to celebrate with Mike because that's how he knew he'd be in the pictures. But Randy hit the ground and had his hand on the ball. And I'm like, dog, Mike gonna mess around and haul off and hit you. This is not, you're not Mike. Like, I feel like no matter who had the ball at the end, you know, there's always somebody that throws it to the sky. Nah, man, whoever on the Bulls had the ball at the end, go hand the ball to Mike. No matter what we gonna do with the ball, Mike? You wanna throw the ball in the air, Mike? Let us know, Mike.
With that series, I saw you talking about the kemp sign.
Yes, yeah, legalized kemp. Very 1996.
I immediately went to go look to see if there was a t-shirt.
Yes.
That was that was a legalized kemp t-shirt. I mean, kemp had some underrated nicknames. Rain Man, that's pretty dope too.
He's good, man. Like, it was one of those where, like, if you weren't there, we're not really going to be able to explain it to you. Like, I don't feel like this era has enough of those guys that you just like because you liked them, right? Like, everything is so much evaluated now in the context of the metrics where what'd you like about Sean Kemp? Man, he just dunked hard on people. You know, like, we have overstated to a degree actually how good he was. Doesn't matter, right? It's what he meant to us. It's what it felt like watching Sean Kemp. And he's one of those guys, man. Also, shout out to Gary Payton. Don't let Mike fool you. Gary Payton held Mike to 36% shooting, more turnovers than assists, and like below 24 points a game in those three games where he was guarding him. Where Mike's like, I had no problems with the glove. You notice they ain't put no video up to support that he had no problems with the glove. You notice nobody had any numbers to support that he had no problems with the glove. Gary Payton was right. All those things he was saying were correct.
What do you think about people talking about the league being watered down back then? In terms of the whole 90s, when you have like the expansions that happened in 88, 89, and then yeah. again in 95, the expansion with the two Canadian teams. Mm-hmm. That Sonics team, you know, they still had Kemp. They still had Payton.
Yeah.
Hall of Famers. That Magic squad, Shaq, Penny.
Yeah, the league was, I mean, expansion is going to do that, right? Like, you add 30 players. Like, each of those years, they added 30 players who otherwise would not have been in the NBA. You know what I mean? So that is a thing. Like, let's not pretend as though expansion does not water down the product, but it's also happening as the talent pool is expanding and there are more people who are able to play. So I do agree with the idea that the league was more watered down. Like, you gotta think about, man, like the Celtics days, man, there's 8 teams in the league. You know what I mean? That's basically 100 dudes in the NBA at that point. So there's something to it. However, that isn't really applying to the teams that got to the finals. Like, that Seattle team, Sean Kemp, Gary Payton. Gary Payton's a better player, so we should say Gary Payton first. But Gary Payton, Sean Kemp, Detlef Schrempf. Like, if Hersey Hawkins or Kendall Gill is your fourth best player, I mean, you got a pretty good team, right? Like, that was a strong team. 97-98 is Stockton and Malone, right? Like, we're talking about two Hall of Famers. Those are strong teams. Like you say, the 95 team, the Magic, right? That team was set to rise. They were going to be the dominant power in the East, it looked like, until Mike came back and then until Shaq left. So, yeah, this is not the league that it was before, but there are also just a lot of really good dudes who happen to be playing in the NBA. Like, this is a period where we truly started seeing the expansion of athleticism, like the children of Michael Jordan are now coming into the NBA. So that's where I disagree with the idea that the league, like, there's something to be said for watered down, but I don't think it matters in the way that we evaluate the Bulls. I mean, hell, the league, what you also had was more player movement. So the 60s are the least watered down era of the NBA, and the Celtics won the championship basically every year of the decade.
Time for one more thing before Dawkins joins. LeBradford Smith.
Yo, poor LeBradford Smith. All I did was have a good game when Mike didn't have a good game. And this dude just made something up. Like I was thinking about that when Nick Anderson did that 45, ain't 23 thing. I was like, Nick, what are you thinking? And somebody hit me and was like, you might as well either you say it or Mike go make something up. And so poor LeBradford Smith just gets destroyed. Destroyed. The next night. Why? Because Mike needed to make something up to play against the Bullets. Do you think that they called LeBradford Smith and asked him to sit for an interview? And he turned it down. I feel like I would have shown up. Or he don't think that is funny. Right? Or he's like, he saw that Hall of Fame ceremony and was like, he called that dude from high school just to clown him in front of the world. That ain't about to be me. Mike ain't about to make a joke of me and be like, oh, incorrect. He's going to do that whether you show up or not.
Speaking of people that went up against Mike and won or lost, may have a surprise for people on Sunday morning, may drop a little The Right Time Extra that we actually taped a couple years ago.
Oh, yeah.
One guy that came up against Mike and won in a one-on-one. So be on the lookout for that on Saturday or Sunday.
Indeed. It is that time of week where we have a guest on joining us now. If you saw the Scheme on HBO documentary about this Southern District of New York inquiry into, I can barely understand, to be perfectly honest, but I recommend that you check it out. But the center of the story was around a young man named Christian Dawkins, and Christian is joining us here today. My man, how are you?
Pretty good. How you doing today, boss?
Hey, man, I'm doing all right. And I really stumbled over describing what was going on with the Scheme, because it's like what they were trying to catch is still something that I struggle in trying to get like a great answer for, right? Like, it's Southern District of New York decided they were going to look into money into college basketball, and then it seemed like they had no idea what they were doing after they started.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess the best way to describe it, and part of the reason why the documentary was called The Scheme, because everybody was kind of plotting or planning against each other without the other party knowing it. I guess if you're saying, if you're confused, I was in the case for years. We're still dealing with it. I'm still confused, because for me, the biggest thing was, I don't understand why they would try to stop the players from getting paid anyway. Like, if I'm a prosecutor, I'm trying to do everything in my power to make sure they can get paid, not cut their water off, basically. So I really don't even know what the purpose was at this point. The only person that could really answer that is the Southern District, basically.
But like, I understand, even if I don't defend it, like why the NCAA goes about these things as they do. I think the development with this for a lot of people was, and you know, we've seen this kind of gradually happen through years, like the football case at the University of North Carolina, but basically where NCAA rules were becoming the law. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, was maybe the most unsettling part for me. Like, because it seems to me, and you tell me if I've got this wrong, there's a lot of conversation on phones about things that people could look at and be like, damn, why y'all talking about this on the phone? But it seems like nobody ever considered the possibility, like, why would the FBI be concerned with this, right? Like, we don't need to talk in code about this. This is not their concern.
So everybody who's close to me, basically, that was the question they had. Why would you be talking on the phone? This doesn't make any sense. You know, you're sending emails. You've got all this stuff in writing. And that was my rebuttal, was why would I think that we were doing anything that would be considered a crime? We're making deals. No one's being hurt. No one's stealing from each other. Like, everything was above board as it pertains to, you know, our communication amongst each other. So, you know, I definitely agree with that theory. That's something that hasn't really been acknowledged, is everybody that was involved, none of us thought that we were doing anything that could be considered a crime. So there was no reason to cover up anything or not talk on the phone or whatever the case may be, or to essentially operate like real criminals, basically.
Now, there's a space between something being a crime and you can make the argument that you were doing something that one would say that you were not supposed to do. Like, did you ever have that feeling about this? Because if the NCAA did show up on this, then we did know that people would get in some measure of trouble.
Well, that's the thing. The NCAA, I mean, again, if you take it back years to our headspace, the NCAA can't enforce their rules, because if you're dealing in cash, or if you're not willing to talk to them, they can't subpoena anybody. They can't tap anyone's phone. So it's like no one involved in the college basketball, college football space is really worried that much about the NCAA rules, in my opinion, because how realistically, unless something just gets displayed publicly, which no one's really doing that, how can anybody get caught violating the NCAA rule if you really think about it? Because the measures to investigate, the NCAA just doesn't have, they need people to cooperate with them, and no one's going to cooperate when they know that they could lose their job or not be able to play. Like, no one's doing that. My headspace definitely wasn't, I have to abide by the NCAA rules. Maybe the coaches were, but for me, I never thought, I can't be doing this because of NCAA rules. That never crossed my mind. I frankly never cared about their rules. They're stupid to me.
Now, for people who have not seen the Scheme, I think it's worth noting that you come up in basketball, right? Like, your dad mm-hmm. is a basketball coach, you know? So for people who did not see this, how did you get to the point where you were a guy who was basically connecting players with the people they needed to be connected with?
Basically, just one thing led to another. You know, I started a travel team to honor my brother.
And how old were you when you did that?
He passed away when I was 16. Yeah, so I was 17. And, you know, we ended up building a program out pretty good. We had a lot of top players, a few guys that ended up making it to the NBA, NFL. And I ended up transitioning to working for a business management accounting firm and end up getting some guys that were first round picks. And from there, everything just kind of exploded, basically. And, you know, I ended up working for Andy Miller, who at the time was an elite agent. you know, essentially I was handling most of the recruiting and most of like the day to day management of a good portion of the clients there. So things just kind of snowball from one to another, and you make a relationship and that leads to another relationship. And I just kept building basically, and it led to what it led to essentially.
Now, when did you realize or you felt like you had an understanding of how this game was played?
Probably when I was like 17 or 18, I had Josh Jackson on my travel team. And at that time, he was a rising sophomore. So he was the number one rising sophomore in America. At that moment, everything like became real because, you know, it was somebody in my orbit who, you know, essentially everybody in the basketball industry was trying to become a part of his process, basically. So that was probably my first introduction to high stakes, elite level, you know, the business of basketball, basically.
Now, at that level, I'm always curious, how much of these conversations that go on, is it really just kind of like adults and adults? Because I can never get a great handle on how close this actually gets to the players themselves, other than, hey, this player is really good. And it's just like, hey, nice to meet you. Now, who do I talk to?
You know, it's a situational thing. I mean, some parents, you know, you have some fathers who have all the juice, and whatever their vote is the final say. And you have some kids who do care, because some players don't care for real. Like, they don't really care about all the extra stuff. They just want to hoop or play football, whatever the case may be. But you have some players who do care, and you have to, you know, recruit them as well. Sometimes it's a travel team coach. Sometimes it's another family member. Like, it could be, you know, a college coach in some cases. There's numerous scenarios that present themselves, but definitely sometimes the players don't know what's happening. I've been involved in situations where the player's totally blindsided. And then I've also been in a situation where the player's involved with everything. So it just depends on the situation and the way the process has kind of been structured and handled from, you know, the powers that be as it pertains to the player side of things.
Now, on the player side, I always find it interesting because, like, I always say, I get somebody to do my taxes because I do my taxes once a year, right? Mm-hmm. Or, like, I have an agent to negotiate my contracts because I do it once every 3 years. I need somebody who does this all the time, right? Mm-hmm. Who knows how this goes. Like, how much of a wild card is it for you when you start dealing with parents? Because there's no telling what you get and what you get with a parent, because there's no telling what they think is possible.
So, yeah, I mean, that makes the representation business tricky. It's not even so much just the parents, it's everybody that's kind of involved. Every player thinks that they are the best, or at least they want to be treated and maximized as much as possible. So regardless if it's the number one pick or an undrafted player, it's going to be the same amount of work and maintenance and servicing. Like, it just kind of is what it is. So I wouldn't say the parents can be a problem per se. Sometimes in today's day and age, everybody has access to information. And sometimes people's comprehension or interpretation of information is not all the way accurate. So that's probably the biggest job I think, you know, somebody who's in that representation space has to do, is essentially just verify and shoot down most of the rumors or BS that come to parents and come to people around a player, because it is a 24/7 cesspool as it pertains to people recruiting and people trying to steal clients and everything like that. So definitely the people of influence around the player, managing them is just as important as managing the player or the talent itself, basically. Like, you have to manage the whole situation.
Well, what made you decide that this was the game that you wanted to play?
I was always around basketball. That's been a constant in my life from day one. And I obviously wasn't good enough to become a professional. So it was the closest thing where I can kind of use my talents and my skills. Being I have a pretty good business mind for the most part. So I looked at it like I can fuse what I'm talented at with something that I'm passionate about. And that's essentially how I made the decision to try to go full steam ahead, you know, in the agent business.
Now, you were like one of these lemonade stand kids. Like, I get the feeling that you was the dude that was selling somebody something at every step of the way.
In the documentary, you know, when they say, when it's like I was 11 with, you know, starting a scouting service, that's accurate. Like, I was writing scouting reports and ranking players and stuff, you know, in middle school, getting paid for it. So I've always kind of been hustling or trying to figure it out.
You ranked yourself.
Yeah.
Like, we can't leave that part out.
No, I mean, I think you have to, right? Like, if you, I mean, think about it. If you're going to be playing basketball and you're going to be also scouting, how can you not scout yourself? I mean, it's kind of like, you have to do that, right? I mean, that was how I looked at it. Like, I can't leave myself out of this scouting report. That would be stupid.
Dude, that was the best part. Like, I saw that, and it honestly made me look at every scout completely differently, right? Because I'm like, I have to take you guys' word for anything. This dude is 11 years old and put himself on a scouting list, and somebody was like, yo, get somebody down there to go check him out.
No, that's definitely my dad at the time was like, Christian, you shouldn't be ranking yourself. Like, you're not that good. You're going to have people coming to see you and players trying to take your head off. And he was right. Like, people will be trying to, like, because I ranked myself pretty high, would be like, I'm trying to knock this Christian Vaughn. At the time, my name was Christian Vaughn. I didn't have my dad's last name yet. But at the time, everybody was gunning at me because of me ranking myself. So it definitely was
crazy. I had not thought about that part, that you put the bullseye on yourself. 100%. The kids are like, yo, I'm about to show you.
Yeah, exactly. No, literally. That, and they're out there killing me, crossing me, dunking on me, everything, just because I ranked myself, basically. So, no, that was probably not the smartest, most strategic moment in my life.
You know, it's interesting, though, when, like, I hear when you talk about the agent game, it's like I think about different people, folks that get into it and then they realize that they're kind of out of their depth or that it's a game that they find to be shady and that they don't want to participate in. You seem to love this, though.
I mean, the game is the game. Like, I don't care what you do. First of all, every hustle is the same to a certain extent. And it's like, regardless if you're doing that or something else, like, no, your job isn't going to be easy. The thing that makes the agent business tricky, I think, where most people probably get the most frustration, you can fire your agent at any time. So when you've put in all the work, you try to build something up, you've grown with a client, and then it's time to do the deal, and they leave you. I mean, that could cause frustration for anybody. So that's where I think most of the resentment comes from, is the business isn't structured in a way that kind of protects the agents. There's no union that is overseeing that for them. The agents are part of the players' union. So that, I think, is what drives most of the resentment of the business. I don't really think, you know, most people don't think it's a fun job or something that they can handle. It's just the stuff that comes around, it can get a little tricky sometimes. But for me, it kind of was what it was, essentially.
But I also think that for some people, they look at that and see that as a game that does not necessarily attract the most honest people.
There's some great agents, dude, like some people who are really, I think the issue, the connotation around agents is just like, and this is the truth about it. Like, when you're representing somebody, you got to do whatever you got to do to get your client, put him or her in the best possible situation. So an agent can't just be 100% on the side of, you know, I don't know if you want to call it like being ethical or whatever the case may be. Like, you're going to get into the gray area because at the end of the day, you're representing somebody else and your job is to put them in the best position. It has nothing to do with you and who you are as a person. Like, sure, everybody would love for stuff to be completely above board and completely honest. But it's like, if you vowed to take care of somebody and make sure that him and his family or her and her family is straight, you got to do what you got to do to make a complete admission, basically. So at the end of the day, you know, agents may get into the gray area or you know, you may have to deal with a team a certain way or a situation a certain way. But I think that's your job. Like, I don't understand, like, what people think an agent is really supposed to do. Because you have a fiduciary responsibility to make sure that your client is taken care of as much as possible. I mean, that's the gig. So I do hear the sentiments that could say, you know, agents may not operate in the most above board manner. But at the same time, there's certain situations that do come across when it pertains to representing somebody. And you have to do what you have to do to make sure they're taken care of.
Yeah, I also figure that in your early 20s, that had to be a hell of a fun gig.
Yeah, I mean, at that time, you know, I was making money. I was around what I loved and I was pretty successful at it at that time. Like, yeah, it was a dream job for me.
Now, again, for the folks who have not seen the documentary, which I recommend, how did you wind up meeting the people who turned out to be undercover agents?
So at the time I was dealing with a financial advisor named Manish Sood, and Manish, he managed over $1 billion. He had his own bank. He was a chairman of a bank in Princeton, New Jersey. Like, this was an official guy. And he basically brought them to me. I was trying to raise capital to build a management business to go out on my own. And Manish essentially referred them to me as real estate people who invested into his fund. And, you know, they wanted to get into sports. And he basically brokered the introduction. So that's how they came about into my life.
Now, what I found interesting about the documentary is that you sniffed it out pretty quick. Like, it didn't take you long before you realized that something was amiss. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, That's true.
I'm curious, like, why not walk away from them earlier?
Again, I think it goes back to, put it like this. When they arrested me, it took about an hour for them to convince me that they were the FBI. Because they didn't, like, when I came into the room, it wasn't like, you're arrested. It wasn't like that. It was they were trying to get me to work with them. So even then, I didn't believe that they were the FBI. Because again, to this day, for the life of me, I can't believe that this level of attention and resources went into people who, this is a fraud case where nobody made money. Like, it never crossed my mind.
Yeah, I would have thought the FBI would have done a little more research, because they really seemed to believe that the way that this game worked was that, like, college coaches showed up with envelopes of cash and handed them over themselves. They seemed to think like they were going to somehow manage to get Sean Miller in a room.
Yeah, I think that this is the thing. If they get the white people to cooperate, they can get everybody. Like, it ain't, they could have, if they got people to cooperate with them and had the relationships with those level people. Like, if their original plan was to get me to do what they did with Marty Blazer, when they did arrest me or they did pull me to the side, their plan was for me to wear a wire and do what I was doing. So if that would have happened, everybody could have possibly been in the same position. That was their original plan. It wasn't so much that they didn't understand the business. They were trying to build crimes, basically. So you need, they labeled the coaches public officials, and they needed them to be involved in order to create a crime. You can't, there's no other way to create a crime without them, and the NCAA rules. So they needed those two things to be prevalent in the case, or you can't have a case. There's no crime that says you can't give someone money. Or even if you said you paid someone to go to college, I mean, that ain't a crime. Like, none of these things are real crimes on the surface. They needed these things to build a case.
And they also, basically with Marty Blazer, it almost feels like normally they try to roll up. It seemed like they got to Blazer and kind of tried to roll down to you to get back up.
Marty, you know, he's not the type of guy who's going to have those kind of relationships or make people feel comfortable enough to talk to him about those kind of things. We didn't know at the time that he was stealing money and everything like that. That news didn't come out until pretty much the end of the investigation. But they needed somebody who could kind of wiggle into the areas that were of interest of them. So that was their reason for, you know, essentially wrapping me into the investigation. I was the point person that can kind of navigate amongst all the different levels that they wanted to access, basically.
Yeah, I find it interesting, like, the thought that they really did have to convince you that they were the FBI. Like, I've been picturing you in there like, come on, man, stop.
No, I literally was like, I don't believe you. I didn't believe them until they pulled out the computer and started playing phone calls with me. And then I was like, okay, like, this is probably the real thing. but because you got to remember, again, I kept asking them, what crimes did we commit? And they wouldn't tell me straight up, like, you did X, Y, Z. Then finally, they was like, you know, they read the arraignment or the indictment. And they were like, you know, you have wire fraud on here. And I'm like, wire fraud? That's when you steal money. Like, I didn't steal no money. Like, what are y'all talking about? And at that point, they was just like, you got to talk to a lawyer, basically, to break everything down for you. But yeah, like it definitely was an unbelievable moment. It definitely, again, I'm still not completely there where it's like, this is a real situation where they actually went through all the stuff that they went through. Again, I don't even know what they stopped, because the NCAA has even changed their rules. I don't even know what happened. Like, what was the purpose of doing any of this, basically? Because now what we did is all completely above board. So it's all just complete waste of time, in my opinion.
When watching the documentary, one thing I thought that was interesting is because I'd hear you and it made perfect sense. You're just like, this is ridiculous, and all the reasons it was ridiculous, and all the people that as this was going on, you're like, yo, this is stupid, right? Like, even the feds and the way they were trying to get coaches. You're like, look, man, this is stupid. This is not the way to do it. So how do you wind up being the only person that goes to jail?
So I went to jail. I only been in jail one night. I haven't served out any like prison sentence because we were appealing the case. What happened was I got arrested on a weekday and I had to see a judge. You know, essentially they had no choice but to put me in there because I couldn't see a judge immediately. So that's essentially how that thing went down. It was a situation where they needed me to be arraigned and they had to hold me.
Got you. Because, I mean, it did seem that when all the stuff came out initially with the news reports before we started getting more stuff behind it, it was almost like they had you as kind of the kingpin, right? Mm-hmm. They positioned it as though you were a man that had a level of sway that may not be accurate.
No one has the level of sway that they tried to make me out to have. Like, the business just doesn't work like that. It's too fragmented. No one's going to have complete monopoly on the business of sports. Like, it's just not going to happen. So that's actually what made me not cooperate and not like plead guilty and stuff like that. Cause I looked at it like, man, this is, if somebody don't fight back or if somebody don't take a stand, like the news reports will be the facts at that point. And I knew that everything that was reported was not factual, not even close. So for me, that was one of the biggest things. I'm like, if I don't go to trial, if I don't get a chance to tell my story, this is going to get swept under a rug and this is going to be history. And it was, I didn't want that to be the case.
Well, it's also hard to ignore that it seemed like only the black dudes have gone down on this, except for a couple of like shoe companies, like Marty Blazer, the guy in the shoe company, but like the coach level was all these black assistant coaches seemed to be the ones that got caught in all the hell. There seemed to be phone calls with Will Wade and Sean Miller that may not be criminal, but definitely seem to be damning. But it does seem like the black people are the ones paying most of the price here.
This is 2020, and it's like this ain't nothing changed, basically, at the end of the day. Like you said, I'm not gonna call them direct, you know, I'm not gonna say it's a direct case of racism because there is white people that are charged in our case. But you can definitely see where white privilege is a real thing. I mean, even the fact that Marty Blazer can get arrested for stealing $4 million from people and then turn around and ask the feds, can he not be arrested and build a basketball case? Like, there's no way a black man, if I steal $4 million from somebody, I'm going to prison for a long time and it ain't nobody gonna hear me out. It ain't gonna be no one trying to help me build a case. Like, those things just don't happen for black people. Or even with the fact that for years you've had the NCAA just hoard money and keep everything for themselves. If black people were doing that to white players and white families, like, this would be a COVID level crisis where the whole world shuts down. So it's like, listen, white privileges are a very, very real thing. And, you know, listen, I'm not a racist person. I have white friends, white business partners. At the end of the day, you know, there needs to be more attention paid and it needs to be a cognizant effort to change some of the systemic racist undertones that are prevalent in sports, basically. Like, you know, African Americans are the talent to a certain extent. But if you look at all the positions of power, you know, whether that's the college, professional, it doesn't really matter. The people that are pulling the strings are all Caucasian. Not that they're not qualified, but I would have to think if we're the ones driving the revenue and essentially 75% of the talent base, I would think that we probably have some executives that can handle the job as well. So the black guys definitely took a fall for their white bosses. And I think that's not something that is uncommon. And you really look at it.
And the pressure is on the assistants to get the players. I think that's the part that kind of gets lost, is that it seemed like a lot of these guys were operating on the urgency of, I have to get players. Like, what was wild to me was the thought that some of these dudes were actually writing their own checks in order to make this happen.
That came out through the trial. I didn't even know that. When you had coaches basically going into their like retirement to make sure everything can be handled. Cause you got to remember this. When you're a college, you know, basketball, football program, you're recruiting. You're not just recruiting one guy. You're just trying to be in the mix with as many elite level guys as possible so you can get somebody. So them unofficial visits, all that kind of stuff, like somebody got to pay for that. When people coming from kids coming from Houston to visit at Michigan. I'm not saying that Michigan does this at all. I'm just saying, using an example. But like, who's going to pay for that travel? Who's going to pay for those unofficial visits? Like there's so much minutia that coaches have to take care of for their players. Like you said, like these assistant coaches weren't doing anything that isn't their job. Like you have to get top players to win. The ADs are paying these coaches millions of dollars to get these kids. Like, this isn't, they're not getting paid that much money to lose or to be mediocre. And the only way you're going to win games is if you have the most talented players for the most part. So definitely the coaches are all under the pressure to perform and to win games and drive revenue. And at the end of the day, it's just a byproduct of capitalism and a multi-billion dollar system. Like, it is what it is, basically.
Now, I understand also that you are not responsible for the production of the documentary, but I was disappointed that we didn't do more about the suit man. The suit man wound up being, Ray Sugar wound up being the most interesting secondary character in this whole situation, right? Cause like when I looked up, like I was imagining, like when you think about looking up and seeing your name on this, when I looked up at one of those and looked at the chart and it's the dude who makes suits.
Yeah.
That's what I looked at this investigation. Like, so what are we doing here?
No, it's funny that you said that. I don't know if you know Rayshon, but I would definitely agree with you. Rayshon is an unbelievably interesting character. I don't even know what happened with him in the case. They split us up as it pertains to, we had different judges. But no, he definitely is an unbelievably interesting person and would have been an unbelievable character to be in the documentary for sure.
Just so you know, we do this thing on the podcast where we play music over something, like I'm going to talk to you about it, but it's not going to go over on the podcast. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your patience. A representative from the right time will be with you shortly. Your current hold time is
15 seconds.
Rayshon is a TV show in itself. Like he is, forget the case. Like someone should just, he could be the level of reality TV star of like a Flavor Flav. Like he's amazing.
Yeah. When this first came out, my radio shows and stuff about this, we weren't talking about Christian Dawkins. I ain't really know nothing about you. I was all about the suit man because everybody knows a suit man.
Yeah,
who's no always question. Like, yo, man, you got to get you some suits. And I thought about it, though, but like for the coaches, especially like former players and stuff like that, these 6'5", 6'6", dudes, you need somebody who does suits, 100%. Right? And so he gets in, he meets one, and then it's like, yo, you got a suit man? All right, cool. Okay, cool. Oh, he's in Atlanta. We go there and recruit all the time.
And now you got the suit man. His suits were ridiculous. Like his stuff was fire. Now, like I got to give Rayshon credit where it's due. He wasn't bringing no BS suits to the table. Like he was fly if he was a client of Rayshon's. He dressed some of my guys in the draft. And Rayshon would be fly too. He had a perfect body for a suit, tall, like you're saying, like, Rayshon definitely had his business grew pretty quickly because he had great product. And like you said, he was hustling. He was everywhere.
And that speaks to like kind of the general theme of this, though. What we're talking about is how so much money is there based around the talent of the players. Because this is a whole nother industry that we're talking about that, you know, spurs off of what starts with the players.
The suit business, you got, you know, the collegiate licensing business is a $1 billion industry. You have obviously the media rights is a $1 billion business. You have, you know, colleges now, like even at Texas now has a Longhorn network. Like that's money right there. Like there's so many things that are happening or orbiting around the space due to the talent and so many business that are derivatives of essentially the players not being compensated. So there's so much cash flow out there that's just free basically for people to come in and be entrepreneurs and capitalize off of it because the talent is getting nothing. Man, the collegiate business alone has to be worth $10 billion moving through that a year, you know, between ticket sales, merchandising, the media rights, you know, like you said, you have stuff like suits, just like BS ancillary stuff like that. But like those right there can be $1 million businesses. And there's more than one Rayshon. You know, you have financial advisors, you got people who are moving like vehicles. Like there's so much stuff that is happening around athletes and just talented people because they're worth so much revenue at the end of the day.
Now, what do you think about this story where a woman who had signed on to work as Zion Williams' marketing agent and he ultimately went in a different direction? She now appears to be trying to tell everything. I can't speak from here whether or not it's true, but she has demanded that Zion tell about the relationships with Duke, the relationships with the shoe companies. Like, what do you think when you see a story like that where somebody who has been involved in this all of a sudden decides to share with the world?
Well, I think for one, she's doing that. Her lawyers are doing that to obviously leverage them to try to make a settlement. I think this is a pure settlement play. I think that's pretty obvious. I mean, listen, I wasn't involved with him signing with her or him going to CAA. So I don't know all the specifics or the details. But from my interpretation, I'm gathering that she has a relationship or represents Usain Bolt. So she obviously had a great relationship at Puma through Usain Bolt. From what I was told, she substantially negotiated the terms of a deal with Puma for Zion that essentially was close in terms or figures to the final deal that he ended up signing with another agency. So I guess the argument is just going to be made of, you know, obviously I'm sure Zion has to pay the agency who did his deal something, but does he have to pay both? Is she entitled to a commission? Because, you know, if it's accurate that the deal was based off of the negotiations that she had already did, if it's accurate, that that is the case, then I guess the question just becomes, does she have to get paid for the work that, that end up, you know, being done? For me personally, I think that the best thing for everybody is just to settle and get this thing over with. It's not good business for nobody to be getting subpoenaed and getting deposed about this stuff. Like, it's, take it from me, get it over with, and let's just, y'all should just move forward. Everybody needs to try to be friends on this one.
Well, like, how, yeah, for you, and I guess I should ask this sooner, but you mentioned it there, like, how truly stressful was all of this for you?
My life was fine. I thought I was in a good place. Everything's good. I'm making money. I'm living my life. And then you wake up one morning and it's gone, literally. So it's like, I literally had to start over from everything that I had built from a young guy to 24, as it was how old I was when I was arrested. I had to essentially restart and rebuild my life completely over. So that's going to be an arduous process for anybody, a difficult process for anybody. I wouldn't say I was like, my threshold for pain is pretty high. Like, I can move forward and kind of have tunnel vision and lock in and do what I need to do. But it definitely is stressful. It definitely wasn't something that was easy to navigate at all. I mean, and I'm still having to deal with it. I'm trying to move forward completely and put it behind me, but it's still something that's always, you know, around, you know, orbiting around me. So it's a big deal. And it definitely was something that was difficult for sure.
Now, I found it interesting that in the end, in the documentary, after going through this, you are now working in the music business, which seems as stressful as any industry could possibly be. Why that direction?
Because at the time, my transferable skills at that time, I'm thinking like, okay, I know I can be a manager, and I needed to go into a business that if I did become a felon, that wouldn't be like the topic of conversation. Like, it's like, there's plenty of people who,
yeah, you don't rate.
Yeah. It's like, who cares, basically? Like, my thing in music is like, get out of here, bro. Essentially, I was like, you know, I have to figure out a way to rebuild my life. And I end up finding some artists, and the kid, his name is Katil, and he end up, every label end up wanting to sign him. And we end up basically doing a label deal at Atlantic. So I don't technically work for Atlantic. I have a partnership with my label in Atlantic, basically.
Yeah, because the one thing about the music game is, and I've covered that and been around that and everything else, that is the who knows what's going to happen next industry of all industries. Like, after you've been in it for a little while, how do you feel? Like, what's your thoughts on what it's like to work in the music industry?
Especially now with the influence of technology and how, like, readily artists can essentially distribute his or her product without going through a label. You know, I think the music business is changing rapidly because you don't necessarily have to have a label anymore to put out your records. Whoever controls distribution, as we all know, is the king of whatever business. And there really isn't a real distribution monopoly in music. You have so many distribution companies. You've got the major labels. Like, stuff's rapidly changing. So I think that's something that is interesting, and is always something that's new every day. And I also think the biggest difference between music and sports, music is much more subjective. Like, we can argue that LeBron James isn't better or is better than Kawhi Leonard, but at the end of the day, we all would agree that they're both exceptional. Like, it's no question. In music, it's all about how, you know, a record or artist makes you feel. So one person could think this artist is God's gift to humanity, and someone else may have never heard of them or thinks that they're whack. So that's the biggest thing, is as it pertains to identifying talent and who's who. It's a much more of a it's a wider range of opinion than it would be, you know, for a professional athlete or something like that. I didn't need nobody to tell me if you were a pro or not. Like, I can look at you and evaluate you. In music, it's like a gamble, man. Like, the artist I have, Katil, that I started with, he's legitimate. I think most people would agree that he has the capabilities to be a star. It's not easy to find, like, someone who is going to be around for multiple albums and not just a record that's picking up through TikTok or whatever the case may be. That's what I think is probably the most difficult adjustment, is just identifying who's the person that you should be investing, you know, million. When I sign an artist, it's $1 million record deal. Like, this isn't a small investment. So, you know, that's the biggest thing, is figuring out who to allocate resources to and who to get behind and put all your focus into.
Could you ever see a chain of circumstances that brought you back to basketball?
Listen, at this point in my life, is I have way too much stuff going on to be in a day-to-day capacity like how I was. I mean, I've got the label, a publishing company. We've got TV film projects moving. There's so much stuff that's happening. I can't, like, day-to-day manage, but definitely think there will be a role or I'll be involved in some capacity moving forward for sure. It'll all come back full circle.
All right. That is Christian Dawkins, my man. I appreciate you greatly joining us. Also, everybody check out The Scheme on HBO. It's really interesting. Definitely worth your time to check out. I tried to leave some stuff on the bone so I wouldn't ruin all the good surprises that were in there, man. But thank you so much for joining us, man. I appreciate it.
Appreciate you for having me, boss. Thank you.
No problem. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this here a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thank you to our guest, Christian Dawkins. Also, remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.